Why don't you drink it?
He says.
In a little while.
He smiles. He's not sure what is happening.
Why don't you drink it now?
He says.
I'm not thirsty now.
Her eyes are like two pills.
Drink it,
he says. She backs away. What is going on? He grabs her wrist.
Drink it.
She won't. She fights him. He gets angrier and angrier. Her eyes fill with tears as he forces her wrist up to her mouth. And now she drops the cup, and it spills away into the grey fog of his imagination.
I will never fuck you,
she shouts. Carl begins to roar. Not words, just a raggedy animal roar. And he folds his hands into clubs and raises them against the shrinking girl.
Carl?
He freezes. Did he make a noise out loud? Did he imagine the knock at the door?
Carl?
Mom is outside the door.
Is that you, honey?
Fuck, shit, fuck! He stuffs the box of pills into his back pocket. He opens the door. Mom is there in her robe. She looks at him, not understanding.
I thought you'd gone.
No. I forgot something.
Why are you in my bathroom? Why is the medicine cabinet open?
Her breath smells of alcohol. He imagines the pill dissolving through her blood. She will not remember anything. Slowly he reaches out his hand to touch her arm. The dressing gown is silky soft.
You're dreaming,
he says. She blinks at him.
You're having a dream.
She closes her eyes and puts her hand on her forehead. Then she says, in not much more than a whisper,
I remembered you weren't wearing a costume.
A what?
A costume for the dance. A costume.
A costume? Fuck! Shit! The Seabrook RFC Clubhouse, a haven for old boys of all ages, where business and drinking can be done without the interference of yahoos or women, is located like a frontier outpost a couple of miles from the school. Close enough for the automator to be summoned from, should anything, go awry at the school dance. The acting principal made no secret of his unhappiness at leaving the hop in the hands of two greenhorns. Or one greenhorn, and Howard. At first, Howard wondered if it was only their lack of experience that concerned him. Could it be he detected a frisson? Did he suspect the chaperones needed a chaperone? On the evidence of the night so far, Greg has little cause for worry. Everything is unfolding with all due propriety. After the vertiginous giddiness of the first half hour, the students have settled down into a manageable, medium-level hysteria. As for their chaperones, they have barely spoken a word to each other. Seeing that it was just the two of them, Miss McIntyre said at the outset, the most sensible thing would be to split up, didn't Howard think? Of course, he'd agreed vigorously. Of course. Since then, they've worked opposite sides of the room. From time to time, he'll catch a glimpse of her, sailing through the three-quarter scale melee. She will flutter her fingers at him, and he'll hustle his features into a brief, efficient smile, before she sails on again, the luminescent flagship of some invading army of beauty. Other than that, not so much as a whisper of frisson. As he meanders around the room, he asks himself what exactly he'd hoped for from tonight. Up to now, he'd been pretending that he wasn't hoping for anything. He'd volunteered for this detail in a kind of deliberate trance, turning, as it were, a blind eye to himself, all self-critical faculties switched off. Even tonight, his grousing to Hallie about what a chore and an imposition it was had been on one level quite sincere. It's only now, when it's crystal clear nothing is going to happen, that his hopes become unavoidable, materializing in the form of jags of disappointment at the same time that they appear, in the cold light of day, preposterous, fantastical, naive. How had he let himself get so carried away by a couple of flirtatious remarks? Was that all it took for him to be ready to betray Hallie? Is that the kind of man he is? Is that really what he wants? David Bowie's Young Americans comes on over the sound system. Howard experiences a fresh pang, this one of homesickness for the house he left less than 2 hours ago. No, that isn't what he wants. He's not going to throw his life away for the sake of a cheap office affair. Tonight has been both a wake-up call and a reprieve. When he goes home, he can begin to put right all the things he's let slide. He can also thank God he didn't get close enough to Aurelie to embarrass himself further. First, though, he may devote himself without distraction to his supervisory duties. Although, aside from judiciously coughing at couples whose petting is straying towards heaviness, there is not much to do but work his way tortuously from one end of the room to the other and back again, a supernumerary presence swigging aimlessly at his punch, which is exactly as awful as the punch at his own midterm mixer 14 years ago. 14 years, he thinks. Half his life. As he makes his invisible way, he entertains himself by superimposing onto the crowd faces from his own past, as if he's walking through it again, a ghost from the future. There's Tom Roach as a gladiator, intact, unbroken, ignoring the girls that flutter about him like hummingbirds, to talk rugby with a young automator, who's chaperoning with Kipper Slattery and Dopey Dean. There's Farley, 2 heads taller than everyone else, his Mr. T costume making him look even skinnier than he already is. And Guido La Manche, sleeves of his sports coat rolled up a la Crockett from Miami Vice, dealing out lines to softly agape girls like a magician doing card tricks. And there's Howard himself, a cowboy, as generic and uncontroversial an outfit as he could think of, though now he sees within it a telltale pun inserted by fate, Howard the Cowherd. But then that nickname still awaited him. He was 14, half-grown, with no lines of destiny to thread him to anyone. Or at least not that he could see. None of them knew yet what their lives were to be. They thought the future was a blank page on which you could write what you wanted. He's woken from these thoughts by a noise at the main doors. It sets up, just as he is walking by, a din of disconnected blows, too violent and disorderly to be called knocking. More like punching, like someone is punching the door. Howard glances about him. No one else seems to have heard. The doors are on the other side of the cloakroom, and the music drowns out all but the loudest exterior noise. But he hears it as it starts up again, an intensifying flurry of hammering and pounding, as if some furious non-human agency were trying to force its way into the hall. Howard shut these doors, as per the automator's instructions, at 8:30 exactly. Another door at the far end of the hall leads to the toilets, the basement lockers, and the annex. But all the main entrances are locked, and the only way in or out of the school is here, through these doors, which cannot be opened from the outside, unless, that is, they are broken down. While he is standing there, the hammering stops. In its place, after a few seconds' prickling silence, comes a single heavy thud. A moment's pause, and then another. This time the boys and girls in the vicinity hear it too, and seek out Howard's eye in alarm. His mind spins. Who is out there? All kinds of grisly thoughts flash through his head. Gangs of marauders, haters of the school, come to terrorize them at knife point, at gunpoint, a Halloween massacre. The thuds get louder. The doors shake, the bolt rattles. Although the majority still do not know its source, the disquiet seeps inwards, through the dance floor. Bodies become still, conversations fall silent. Should he call the automator? Or the police? There isn't time. Swallowing, he enters the shady cloakroom and brings himself close to the door.
"Who's there?"
he barks. He half expects an axe, or a tentacle, or a metal claw to come crashing through the wood. But there is nothing. And then, just at the moment he begins to relax, the wood bulges under another blow. Howard curses, jumping back, then presses down the safety lock and pushes open the doors. Awaiting him outside is a stormy, packed darkness, as though all space from the ground up has been usurped by the ominous thunderclouds. Wrapped within it, tensed for another charge, stands a lone figure. Howard can't make out who it is. Groping around behind him, he finds the light switch and flicks it on.
Carl?
He squints into the blacked-out face. The boy is wearing his everyday clothes, jeans, shirt, shoes, but has smeared his features with soot. A pretty impoverished costume. Somehow, that makes it all the more frightening.
Can I come in?
The boy says. His clothes are wet. It must have been raining. He peers over and under Howard's arm, stretched protectively across the portal.
The door's closed half an hour ago, Carl. I can't let anyone else in now.
Carl doesn't seem to hear him. He's craning and ducking, stretching and shrinking his frame, in his effort to spy into the dance. Then abruptly he turns his attention back to Howard.
Please.
From his lips, the word comes as a shock. For a moment, Howard wavers. It's the start of the holidays, after all, and the automator isn't here to see. But something about the boy unnerves him.
Sorry,
he says.
What?
Carl opens his hands at his sides. He seems to be getting bigger every second, as if he's partaken of some Alice in Wonderland potion. Involuntarily, Howard takes a step backward.
You know the rules,
he says. For a long moment, Carl looms over him, eyes staring whitely out of the black mask. Howard looks back at him neutrally, through the fissile air, not breathing, waiting to dodge a flying fist. But it does not come. Instead, the hulking boy revolves and slowly descends the steps. Instantly, Howard's resolve is pierced by guilt.
Carl,
he calls.
Take this.
Howard extends the umbrella Father Green left under the table.
In case it rains again.
Carl gulps at the hooked black handle under his nose.
Don't worry,
Howard adds uselessly.
You can return it after the holidays. I'll explain.
The boy takes it without a word. Howard watches him pass down the rain-slicked avenue, through the intervals of light cast by the lamps, a row of white moons against the starless sky. With a sigh, he closes the door and slides down the bolt. Re-entering the hall proper, he finds the party in full swing again. From a corner of it, Miss McIntyre observes him with folded arms. He smiles wanly, then hastily removes himself from the dance floor, as DJ Wallace Willis puts on a record sufficiently slow in tempo for the kids, hitherto an amiably bouncing mass, to redistribute themselves into soulfully intertwined couples, kissing each other with varying degrees of accomplishment and Frenchness. Taking refuge at the punch stand, he rubs his eyes and checks his watch. 2 more hours to go. All around him, everyone who has not been asked or has not had the courage to ask someone to dance is vigorously conversing in an effort not to notice the slow-motion epic of desire unfolding on the dance floor. The soundtrack is With or Without You by U2. As he listens, Howard is seized by the unshakable certainty that he sat out this very song at this very punch bowl 14 years before. God, this job! These days he can hardly take a step without falling down a trapdoor into his own past. 5 months ago, Howard had attended his class of 93 10-year reunion in this same hall. Long dreaded, it had proved an unexpectedly pleasant affair. A 3-course meal, full bar, partners left at home until the alumni and spouses golf outing the following day. Unflattering nicknames left unspoken. Enmities of the past carefully let lie. Everyone was eager to appear socialized, to present his adult self, successfully emerged from its chrysalis. They pressed business cards into Howard's palm. They took photos of babies from wallets. They waggled wedding rings and sighed tragicomically. Each reintroduction repeated a truth at once shocking and totally banal. People grow up and become orthodontists. And yet, none of them had been quite convincing. Once you've seen someone firing peas out of his nostril, or trying and failing for a full 15 minutes to climb over a gym horse, it's difficult to take him seriously as a top legislator for the UN, or hedge fund manager at a private bank, no matter how many years have passed. The hall had seemed to Howard no less full of burlesques and pastiches than it does tonight. And he was the pastiche poster boy, for he had actually switched sides from being one of the students to being one of the teachers, from child, as it were, to grown-up. And it had just happened, one event in a long, muddled train of events, without any great catharsis or epiphany on his part, without any interior transformation or evolution, whereby he might have known anything worth teaching. Instead, it was like calling one of the kids from the middle row of his history class and asking him to take over, and while he was at it, pay a mortgage, and fret over whether or not to get married.